Okay. Revelation 14. I think we got to Revelation 14, verse 5. Am I right? I remember us talking about it.
Yes.
Are we through verse 5 or do we need to go back to verse 5?
We pretty much finished five. We were getting ready to start on the first angel's message.
Okay. All right, Bill.
Good to be back.
Yeah. Would you please read verses 6? Do we want to read just the first angel's message and then
Let's do
discuss it?
one angel at a time and see how that
Yeah,
goes.
why don't we do that? So read verses 6 through 7.
All right. This is from the Free Bible version. Then I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven. He had the eternal good news to announce to those who lived on the earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people. He cried out in a loud voice, "Give God reverence and glory, for the time of his judgment has come. Worship the one who made heaven and earth and sea and springs of water."
Okay, something just struck me. This has the word earth in it 2 times at least. Then I saw another angel flying overhead with the eternal good news to proclaim to those who live on earth.
And then the one who made heaven and earth.
And the one who made heaven and earth.
Why is that significant to you?
Because we have a lot about the earth throughout 13 and 14. You have, and chapter 14, no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. And then in chapter 13, you have the beast that comes out of the sea, but then you have the beast from the earth.
So, in my little brain, I'm thinking there's a level of story that starts Revelation focused on sort of the new emerging church of Ephesus and all of those, the seven churches. And it grows into chapter 12 to the cosmic war. And now it seems like 13 and 14 is beginning to focus us again, because the breaking of the seals is universal. It seems to me that the story is universal. But now we're sitting here post 12, and we're beginning to drill back into the play, the theater, the spectacle of Earth. Is that?
Yeah,
Okay.
I think that's a good overview. It seems to me that in the three angels' messages, we could argue that the cosmic and the earthly come together. And maybe we can look at how that works.
As far as the beginning here, an angel, which it doesn't say another angel, you can count angels that show up that are not part of the set of sevens. And it actually, this is the first of seven angels again. We've always talked about the three angels, but if you count them up, there's actually seven.
Aren't there some before this one, though, as well?
Well, yeah, but there seems to be this string of angels that starts here. And Revelation seems to be quite fond of the words number seven.
Well, I was kind of curious how verse 6 is in the original when they describe the angel, because Jonathan has clearly put in another angel.
Yeah, my version has another angel.
So does NET, no.
That must be my translation. It starts out with an angel. Yeah, because it looks like most other translations have another.
New King James as well.
I mean, certainly within just here, there was a voice from heaven. Was that an angel? I don't know. but 13.
I'm going to look it up here in the Greek.
It's allos.
Allos is another. Let's see, 14:6. Yeah, kai eidon alone, angelon. And I saw another angel.
Well, I mean, clearly he's describing what he sees, and he's seen a bunch of angels already, so he's seeing another one.
There is an angel that stands out among the angels in Revelation, and that is the angel who comes down from heaven. That's in chapter 10.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes down, that same angel comes down from heaven again in chapter 18. And when I looked at Revelation from a chronological, and I know that's heresy in scholarship, but I believe there is more than one way to interpret Revelation. If I can be allowed to do that.
For sure.
that angel that comes down from heaven does not fly in the midst of heaven. He stands. And he comes down from heaven. And I believe that that is Christ. Because Christ is the angel of the covenant in the Old Testament.
Now, are there other angels mentioned since chapter 12?
Well, I have a footnote from NET, and they're talking about another angel. And the footnote after they discuss another is that the last mention of angels is in 11:15, which was the seventh angel, because I just looked it up. Seventh angel blew his trumpet and loud voices shouted in heaven.
Okay, that has to do with the seals, isn't it?
That would be trumpets.
The woes. Trumpets.
Yeah. Trumpets, okay.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which one it was.
Seventh angel blowing his trumpet.
Okay. That's the seven trumpets.
So that could actually reset the clock or reset the counter of this. Yeah, there's been angels mentioned before, but that word can also mean different. Not just another, but a different angel.
Oh, yeah. I would certainly allow that and to say it's... Yeah, another one, a different one. I guess that I didn't differentiate between another and different.
I mean, this does start another set of seven, which actually ends with the one in 18, which is Christ.
That's interesting.
But there's these three, but there's actually two more in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
Or three more. There's actually three more at the end of this chapter, which is 6, and then if you add the one in 18, it's 7.
This is one of the places where I really value the historicist view. If chapter 10 is the start of the last movement, or a new movement, maybe is a better way to put it, and Christ comes down to start that movement, then chapter 18 is where that movement is climaxed.
Hmm.
And Christ comes down again.
Which would be appropriate being the seventh angel.
Yeah. And that everything in between is part of that movement, including chapter 12, because the Seventh-day Adventist Church is known for, that's too strong a word, but it one of its hallmarks is to develop a cosmic conflict in great detail.
And 12 is the overview of that.
Right. So all of what happens between 10 and 18 is part of the message, in a sense, of that movement. That's how I've looked at it. That's just for your pondering.
And another thing that came to me not too long ago about these three angels is that it could parallel the three paradidomize in Romans 1. Because like you said, if they reject the first angel, you know, then another attempt, and they reject that, and another attempt. And you know, the definition of wrath is God releases them, and then releases them again, releases them again.
Yeah, I wouldn't see that necessarily as parallel, but rather as connected.
Yeah.
So as I look at the new different angel of first one mentioned here, flying in mid-heaven, is that significant in mid-heaven, not high heaven or something?
This, my version is interesting. It says high overhead.
So the message is overhead going around the world, in essence.
So, let's see, 14:6, I saw another angel. Meso, in mid-heaven, it really is meso. It means mid.
You know, the middle of.
Middle of the heavens.
My NET has a note, and their note is a point or region of the sky directly above the earth, high in the sky, midpoint in the sky, directly overhead, straight above in the sky. So it has all of those, which is kind of, if you're looking for something, straight up is easiest place to see it. You know, because you've got trees. I can't see a 5 o'clock, or I can't, you know. So I thought that was interesting position. It's like,
yeah,
this is
that's a really good point.
Nothing's in the way.
Yeah. The most obvious place in the sky.
Yeah.
The least possible to miss.
So everybody in the whole world can see this angel and hear.
My brain is going to Galatians 1 when Paul is saying how quickly you gave up the good news of the gospel. So I'm going to tell you that if even an angel from heaven, we or an angel from heaven comes to tell you a different gospel, let him be accursed or go to hell, whatever version you like. And I say unto you again, if an angel from heaven, so these are references to angels in heaven. So you can't always trust an angel from heaven is the message I get.
These angels flying high overhead, which is what I like, given what the net says, they fly with the eternal good news to proclaim to those who live on earth. So to me, this is where the cosmos, or the cosmic realm, is the heavenly realm, is trying to come to earth.
Here's an interesting connection to this mid-heaven. The same thing shows up in Revelation 8:13. Same phrase.
The eagle flying in mid-heaven, shouting loudly. Disaster.
Horror.
And the eagle is the same word as angel in the Greek. It's angelos. Or agalos.
Angelos. When you have two gammas, that's ang.
Oh.
My footnote just says eagle or vulture. In the pre-Bible, he has a footnote, or vulture.
It might be from other Greek sources, too.
Okay. Which verse in chapter 8 again?
13.
13, yeah. And I saw and I heard, actually, the word is A2. I believe that is eagle.
There's probably discrepancies in the Greek text.
I don't show any footnote for that. And there would be a footnote if there was a variant.
I'm just looking at Strong's, and it's Aglos. A-G-G-E-L-O-S.
Well, there's what did you say?
A-G-G-E-L-O-S.
Yeah.
Angelos.
Yeah, but that's in chapter 12, in verse 12.
No, it's 8:13. That's what it's showing.
I wonder if there's a mistake. I tell you, I find mistakes in some of these very seminal works because they're massive and it's very hard to get it completely accurate because what I have in 13 is Chi Idon Chi Ekousos Enos A2 Petomeno and Mesuranephantai, which is midheaven.
Yeah, that's the same thing that I have in the Strong's except for that one word.
Yeah, A2 is eagle.
Yeah, and mine says angel.
Yeah, but you can't go by Strong's. You have to go by the Greek text.
But there's different Greek texts too, isn't there?
There aren't for that. I have all the apparatus here at the bottom of my Greek New Testament. And it would give me a little letter. I can try looking for 13, 12, 13. And I don't see angelos. So I'm afraid it's a mistake in Strong's.
Now, refresh my mind as we talked about chapter 8. Are we talking, would the eagle be an adversarial message, or are the trumpets and everything related?
Well, the eagle is giving the woes, the three woes.
Okay.
Which my version translates as whore, whore, oh, the whore.
So these are simply announcements in a way that would not be impossible to understand from the, you know, in mid heaven, it's close enough that I could see the spaceships landing.
Well, it means it's a very important announcement that you dare not miss. You know, look up. If you are looking towards the heavens, you have that announcement. If you are looking only to the earth, you may hear it, but it may be blocked by all the other noise.
So it's intended to convey the importance and urgency of the message as opposed to, okay, some location.
Yeah. So there is a contrast here where the eagle is giving a warning of tragedies coming, which is the opposite of what this one is doing.
Right. They're not the same.
But it's the same location.
Yeah.
Urgency and...
So there's an urgency to these last messages. Because if there's only one last message in Revelation, is there not? Besides the three angels. And that's Revelation 18.
Yeah, I think so.
And what is interesting in Revelation 18, verse 1, it says, after these things, I saw another angel coming down out of heaven, having great authority. And the earth, I'm not recognizing a Greek word here, ephotiste, I think is
lit up.
Lit up, yeah, shining with great
illuminated.
Glory. Illuminated with great glory.
That's an interesting contrast, too, is this angel basically stays in mid-heaven, whereas that one is coming all the way down.
Yes, that's what makes me think he's Christ, the coming down to earth, the incarnation. And that's the same angel that in chapter 10 comes down to earth.
Those who dwell on the earth, I've long seen as a code phrase that shows up quite a bit in Revelation, indicating a mindset. You know, it's like a dwelling on the earth mindset, defining reality based on the counterfeit system of reality. So the good news is addressed particularly to the people who don't have the heavenly perspective.
So first of all, you have the good news, and it's eternal good news. To proclaim to those who live on earth, to every nation, tribe, language, and people.
Is that eternal? Would that translate, I don't mean the literal word, but the idea, would that best translate as permanent?
No, because eternal literally means age.
As opposed to another age, or...
Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is, you know, even though in chapter 14, it says the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. Mm-hmm. And many, many Christians read that as eternal.
Mm-hmm.
That is, the hell is eternal. Mm-hmm. And it's ever burning and it's ever smoking and so on. But some of the Adventists, of course, have mapped that out and pointed out that in Jude, verse 7, in the same way Sodom and Gomorrah and the neighboring towns practice immoral sexual relations and pursued other sexual urges by undergoing the punishment of eternal fire, is Sodom and Gomorrah still burning? No. That's been our key text, to say, look, forever and ever does not mean forever. That is true. And in the Greek, it's actually clearer than it is in Hebrew, I think. But in Hebrew, when Daniel stands before Nebuchadnezzar and says, O king, live forever, he's not telling the king to never die. He's simply telling the king, live out your full reign. It's an age. It's a time period. Forever does not have the meaning in ancient Semitic languages of completely unending or infinity.
So forever and ever, as well as eternal.
Mm-hmm. Eternal is simply another translation for forever.
Okay.
So this word is anonios.
Mm-hmm. Which literally means age. Age upon age.
Mine says it means perpetual.
And that's a translation that is reflects a different understanding than I've given.
It says past and future as well.
Well, so if we're talking...
The problem with that is that there's a Christian bias, an ever-burning hell.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything forever is literally forever as it is in English. But as it is in Greek, it means age to age, literally.
Now it says the root word it comes from is an age.
Yes.
So if I come back to the eternal good news,
mm-hmm.
what am I talking about?
The eternal good news is the good news for now, this age to, and it's for other ages, and it's, you know, it does have lasting effect. It can have, and another way to look at eternal is to see that the fire, for example, of Sodom and Gomorrah the effects of that fire are eternal, but the burning is not eternal.
So this is the good news to announce, the eternal good news. I'm trying to put it in the context. So
And we can argue, of course, that is the effects of that good news. The good news itself is eternal in the sense that we're talking about.
The effect is everlasting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Even if there was some point of discovery
of it.
Okay. So as an example, if I look at the totality of the incarnation as... Mm-hmm. good news about God revealed.
Mm-hmm.
That has lasting effect.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it was something that the pre-ages up to that point also had not understood outside of the earth's experience.
Yeah. So there are some things that are eternal in aspect. But that word is still used rather loosely in Aramaic. When I took Aramaic, I had to study for my second semester of it, the Elephantine, some of the Elephantine documents. Elephantine documents represent the documents by a little community of Jews that had fled to Egypt during the time of Nebuchadnezzar's march on Jerusalem. They fled there against Jeremiah's will and God's will. But they developed this little community of Yev. And the name of the community was Yev. And they wrote different documents, had different transcripts of papyrus. And some of them were contracts. And we were working through some of these contracts, and we came to one that was a marriage contract. It was a marriage contract between a man who was marrying the slave girl of another man. And in the contract, it read, "I will marry her forever and ever." A few lines later, "Now, if she does not please me tomorrow or the next day, and I divorce her." How long is forever? They did not see forever in the same way that we did. They did not have a perception of infinity. And that's something we need to keep in mind. These words are tentative, and you have to go by context and what is going on before you enlarge them as the eternality that we have. We just tied to infinity.
I wonder if the only thing that could be tied to forever and ever eternity would be God's character as he changes now.
That's a good point.
Or his principles upon which life is constructed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that was kind of my thought of the incarnation. And
I almost think all things pertain to God. Have eternality in the sense that we think of.
That's the thing.
But of course, the Bible writers may not have caught that.
Correct. That I guess that was the secondary question I was coming to, how they would understand it. And
they would not see it as necessarily infinity.
Okay.
I mean, I've long heard and probably even seconded using this verse as the argument that the eternal good news has been good news before sin ever started, will continue to be good news long after it's gone, because the good news is who God is. But what we're saying is this good news is only applicable to a certain age.
I would suggest that in terms of a principle of God, whatever is of God is eternal. But the Bible doesn't always just look at the cosmic realm and the heavenly realm. The Bible looks at what it is to us here today. The Bible looks at how it delivers to us, how it relates to us. The wonderful thing about the incarnation, it's constantly mediating to us the things of God. And so in that perspective, it's possible that the eternality of it was not as precious to them as it is to us. They were more in the here and now. Whereas we tend to see globally, we tend to see cosmologically, and so on.
I think you're in good company. Paul goes to the mat over God's character in Galatians 1, where he says, some of you gave up the good news about Christ as the gospel, the good news of the gospel. But then he says, you know, there's nothing going to change that. If we or an angel from heaven comes with a different news, good news, it's not good news at all. Don't accept it. He's saying.
Well, I think what we're seeing, and this is something I should point out, that in the change from Judaism to the Hellenistic period, in the Hellenistic period, Judaism became much more static, much more, much less dynamic, and much more in terms of controlling time instead of living in time. The Hebrew, the pre-modern Hebrews lived in time, where, and they didn't try to control it, mark it, or calculate it. They simply lived in time. You know, you can remember Old Testament passages, I think in Amos, there's a statement by Amos that says that it was before so many years before the earthquake. You know, that's how they calculated time. You know, it was an event that happened recently and that marked time. But they didn't have calculations like we have today for time. So I think if we put it in the Greek era, now you're starting to have that marking of time and that suggestion that there is infinity and so on. So it is possible that John in Revelation can grasp that a little more. But John is very Hebraic in his thinking. In fact, I was taught when we read part of Revelation or translated part of Revelation in my intermediate Greek class. Or was it my beginning Greek class? Anyway, it was in a Greek class. That the Greek of Revelation is very poor. It's like someone is thinking in another language and stumbling around in the Greek. And I taught Greek 1 year to some students in Asia, and I was leading them through part of the Gospel of John, and I could not help but see all the Hebraisms in the Gospel of John. That's in the passages that we looked at. I think we've hammered on that topic.
It's good news. It's urgent and important to hear the message, is what I'm picking up from verse 6. And so then, for everyone, nation, tribe, language, people, this would be all-inclusive. From their mindset, would that be?
Yes, that's a way to make inclusion happen. You don't just say all, but you mark it out. Yeah.
Which is so cool of God, you know, because often in some of the mystery religions, there's only a select elite that get the top information and other people are deprived of that. So it speaks well of God, who wants everyone, you know, to hear this eternal good news. It's not as I thought the same thing. This is all inclusive. Mm-hmm. It is collective. It isn't. Yeah, it's just God's way of saying, I want everybody to know this.
The whole family.
Does the 144,000 have a role to play? As I just sort of remember thinking, you know, we have the chapter 14 starts with this background of the 144,000 and their specialness. And then, or was it just in the air and water as I grew up that, you know, they're the remnant or something else? Because this seems like the angel is doing this announcing to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have, I mean, we have a role to play, but it's not necessarily the role I have come to think, it seems like to me.
However, if you look at verse 6, he comes with the eternal good news to proclaim. Is he the one proclaiming it? And he says with a loud voice, and then he does proclaim. So is he solo proclaiming it, or is this the message he's giving to be proclaimed?
I'm open. That's why I asked.
I think it's safer to say everything in Revelation is symbolic. So this isn't a physical, literal angel. And most of Adventist history has not attempted to literalize this. if anything in Revelation, they don't try to literalize this. There's not a literal angel at the pinnacle of the sky saying these literal words.
The angel simply means messenger.
Yeah.
In the Greek.
Well, John is writing what he's seeing in vision or whatever. And then we're left with what's the reality. So for me, I don't see it as the 144,000 only. It would seem to me that anyone
who receives the message.
Well, yeah. So I'm going to go back to 1 John. Those who love are born of God. So his commandment is to love.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm looking, you know, obviously, if you're going to proclaim about giving God reverence and glory, and of course, the question is what, and I'm a little ahead of myself, for the time of his judgment has come. What does that mean? But I'm just that the message is inclusive, and it's for people who have some alignment to the divine for giving that message.
It's for those who accept the good news.
Well, there is a link here, because this cluster at the end of this verse, every, what is it, nation, tribe, tongue, and people, if you link that back to Revelation 5:9, which has the same cluster, and it gives you a clue as maybe to who this is talking about. It says they sang a new song, which just showed up at the beginning of this chapter, saying, "You are worthy to take the book and to open its seals, for you were killed and bought us, or purchased us, for God with your blood out of every tribe, language, people, and nation." So it appears, if you put those two together, that the messengers or messenger or whatever that is delivering this are the ones who are purchased out of those, that cluster of descriptions that the message is being given to.
So it's inclusive.
I was going to say it's very broad, inclusive, and yet would indicate a level of response or reception or whatever the case might be, because God purchased everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the universe back to himself from the affect and consequences of rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
Fallen and unfallen, it would seem to me. I mean, to me, that's part of the eternal message.
Well, the eternal good news is for everybody in the universe, but it does specify those who live on the earth.
Okay. So, to me, this is, there's those who are close to the heart of God in relationship and have been impacted by the story of Revelation. They have something to share, and yet it isn't by proclamation, declaration, affiliation that is necessarily true. Because there's certainly, I mean, I can think of Christians in and outside of my own tradition who I think have done a very poor job, and maybe I'm one of them, I don't know, very poor job at revealing this truth of good news. So, you know, maybe it is it just, anyway, I.
Well,
maybe there are some outside who do a good job at revealing this.
But we're still under the influence of the Father of all lies. We still have propensities to sin, if you will, or to that not trust God, if you will. So to that extent, how much does that permeate our belief of good news if we're not fully trusting God?
Well, what does it mean to fully trust God? I look and say the faith of a mustard seed is insignificant There's not no description of a bar of trust. You have to trust this much in order mm-hmm. to anything. It's relational, and trust should be growing, not static.
I think the trust is tied to the relationship. Whatever we trust someone when we have a relationship where we have the ability to smooth out our differences, to be able to relate to one another. Mm-hmm. And in terms of God, we trust him when we can fully surrender to him, not in an abject kind of surrender, not the surrender of someone who surrenders to an abuser.
Oh, no, mm-hmm. right.
But the surrender to the sovereignty of love, which is a term Ellen White uses several times in Thoughts on the Mount of Blessing.
Mm-hmm.
The sovereignty of love is what we will surrender to if we trust him.
And that surrender grows.
Yes.
As trust grows.
Yes, absolutely.
Because okay. I'm always hesitant to go, well, you know, then you should be like X. And
no.
And I look at...
Don't you think the angels' trust in God has grown exponentially throughout the ages?
and especially in relationship to the incarnation and that revelation.
Yes.
It was not at all what they expected. Their trust had to have. I can't see that it would be static.
Yeah. No.
So my trust in each member that I know here has grown.
See, that's what modernism, which is built on the Greek way of thinking, has lost, is that relational aspect.
Mm.
Because in a static relationship, somebody calls the shots and dictates to you what you must believe or how you must act.
Hierarchical, then.
It has to be hierarchical if you're going to have it static.
Right. Okay. And that's something I can appreciate and need to look at modernism. I don't disagree, because I see a lot of failings of the Enlightenment and modernism, not scientifically, not for advances in civilization, but it's lost something. And that was a nice point. I have to take that with me.
Well, I see relationships as very almost malleable.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that they ebb and flow with circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And how we surmount the circumstances, if they're negative, will define the relationship and the quality of it.
So let me come back then to the first another angel.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt. I just want to make a comment or a question on the faith, the mustard seed that Bill mentioned. I was pondering that. I just, you know, kind of wondering. So obviously seeds don't have faith, right? I mean, it's a metaphor. So what is the mustard seed? It's the smallest, one of the smallest seeds in the garden, but when it grows, it becomes one of the biggest, like the Bible says. So we tend to compare ourselves with others, right? I mean, that's kind of our tendency. And I think what God's saying here is, this mustard seed in metaphorical language believes that what God said about it, that it's going to be, even though it appears to be the small seed, is going to be the biggest, not in a prideful way, but just it believes that. So the faith of the mustard seed is that I'm going to be what God is going to make me. And he believes that completely. That's kind of how I see that. Not the size of the mustard seed. I think that's disorienting. That's just my opinion. What do you guys think?
Good point.
Yeah. So from the same, the belief that I will become what God has intended for me and how he sees me. I think we don't fully grasp the enormity of God's perspective. And I think that my idea that trust grows and is dynamic is one aspect of growing into the truth of God's reality. I don't know if that aligns. So in my brain, it aligns.
So is it the mustard seed that is it the faith that grows, or is it the put, is it what happens grows because of faith? In other words, if my trust in God is very small, but I'm willing to invest it, I'm willing to put it in the ground or whatever, however you do that. And I say, I don't see any evidence of, you know, my usefulness or God's power to do anything, but I'm just going to trust that he does it. Is the size of the mustard seed have more to do with the lack of actualization, which can happen if I simply trust? And it will grow and grow and grow and grow. But what's growing? Is it my faith? Well, my faith will probably grow, but it could also be the actualization of what God wants to do in a person who trusts.
Well, trust is what makes works happen, which is why where James comes in and says, look, it's not enough just to trust, say you trust God, but trust works.
Trust is not stagnant.
No.
Trust with the divine is not stagnant. Let's put it that way. And I even think in just our general relationships.
Trust works by love, right, and purifies the soul.
And love is active, not right, passive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the context exactly of the mustard seed, but it was so often Jesus was saying, you of little trust, if you had the trust of a mustard seed, you would.
You'd be able to say to this mountain, move.
Well, that was said in response. That was Jesus' answer when the disciple says, increase our faith. And that's what he said. Well, if you had enough faith like a mustard seed, you could do this. Actually, I think he was very excited they asked the question.
I would agree.
You're asking the right question.
Better questions, at least. And so I think it's not, again, I would never say there has to be a level of trust. It's just saying your trust is finally hitting a stride where you really want to walk with me. And I think the evidence of Peter's trust wavering in the courtyard of the high priest, and contrast that to John's trust, and contrast that to Judas, who thought he had trust, believed that Jesus would not allow this to happen. And the reaction, to go to Gene's point, Peter was willing for his trust to be renewed, and it appears that Judas couldn't get there.
With Judas, something blocked his trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, he trusted in himself, his ways of doing things, his,
national,
you could say his pride.
National pride.
Really blocked his trust.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and he was completely turned off when Jesus washed the disciples' feet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he goes, this is demeaning. No king does this. This should not be happening. Even though a part of him, as Ellen talks about, was kind of drawn to that, but then he shut that down and went back to that thought. This is not what God looks like. God is not the servant God. And, you know, he didn't trust Jesus's way of doing things. So I thought Rusty's point was excellent, especially when we look at, which we haven't gotten to yet, you know, give God reverence and glory for the time of his judgment has come. Worship the one who made heaven and earth, the sea and the springs of waters. A seed just does what a seed does because God designed it to do that. And when I plant stuff, I'm going, this just blows my mind. I'm putting this little dinky thing in the soil. It's just amazing to me that somehow I just put some dirt on it and some water, and this life comes up from how God designed it. It just blows my mind every time I plant seeds in the garden. So I just go, there's something that God ties directly to that relationship with him that allows us to move into, I trust you. And from that reverence and that awe, and as you see Creator God, which I think is just key, seeing God as creator is just key to everything.
Yes.
Creator, sustainer is just.
I want to follow up, Nancy, with something. So I never thought of this before about that seed. Pete and Bill, you brought up Peter. So Peter, if he had just said to Jesus, you know what, I am that little least of these seeds in the garden. I cannot, you know, instead he said, oh, if everyone else, you know, leaves, I will never, right? Uh-huh. But if he just seen himself as that seed, never thought of it before, I'm to see myself as nothing without God. With God, I can be the biggest in the garden, but of my own self, if Peter would have seen himself as that insignificant seed without God, then he would have said, Lord, save me. Yeah. And I'd never quite put that together about how we see ourselves with, you know, without Christ or without God in our life. And it would end the pride issue. You know, when you, one of the worst things that maybe some of you guys have been there before is, I mean, you are all pretty intelligent. And when you are, what's the temptation? You know, you depend less and less on God, but you depend on your knowledge base or whatever. And so there's a temptation for everyone, right? And so keeping a perspective of really what we can do without God versus what we can do with God is something I'd never put together with that parable. And
it's not, yeah, and it's not God's power merely that makes it happen. It is his love.
Amen.
The only kind of power that God really has is the power of love that gives life and that infuses relationships and that enables us to grow together with others so that we can develop into the kind of human beings that reflect his image.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You probably remember King Frederick in the 1300s. He did the experiment with children, and the nurses were not allowed to touch them. Have you guys heard this before?
I think I have.
So he couldn't speak. They couldn't speak to them. They couldn't touch them. They could only feed them. And without human touch, without mm-hmm. the voice, without love, they died.
Mm-hmm.
He was thinking mm-hmm. they were going to like find out what was the language they were created with in the Garden of Eden. He was thinking it was German, right? Like if they didn't talk, didn't touch them, and then they came out speaking German, that would prove that that was the original language. But then sadly, they died. And so like your point, Gene, is that love is the power. I mean, because obviously Satan wasn't challenging God's power. He's challenging his character. And you're right. Love mm-hmm. wins. It's won in my heart. That's how God won mine. I always believed he was powerful, but I doubted his character.
I like where you're going, Rusty. And John, the same author, John 15, 5 and 6 says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. Those who remain in me produce plenty of fruit. But apart from me, you can't do squat.
Did you read my note in the chat? I just put that in. So thank you for sharing that.
I didn't, but good minds run in the same groove. I just wish I had one.
That's great. Thank you. Yeah.
So I was see how big this plant's already getting? You just planted the seed in the ground and look what's coming out of it already.
Well, so when I come back and say, give God reverence and glory, is it possible that rather than words, it's through the actions of, you know, it's love, it's our relationship with God through the Spirit working itself out in love and not necessarily words?
It has to be experiential. We don't learn by word alone. We learn by experiencing the word.
I think too that one of what I'm coming to see, as I grew up, I can't tell you how many revelation seminars I sat through, and a lot of seminars and, you know, sermons. And yet I've come to see, when I see God as designer and I see the interconnectedness of life, it just baffles me. I think I mentioned, we looked up this thing about trees and how trees communicate with other trees and help other trees out. Other species, if they're not getting enough nutrients, it's just fascinating. And I think when I have a design lens, law view, it totally radically changes my view of God. And I think that's part of what the third angel's message is supposed to be proclaiming. It is, we worship a designer God. He doesn't operate in the Babylonian style. We're going to, you know, the next angel is going to talk about that more intensely, but we worship a designer God who doesn't just make up arbitrary laws, but they are what life is connected to. And without them, life doesn't happen. And I think that's part of what I missed for years and years until Maxwell. And I started going, oh, and Jennings has been very helpful talking about design law. What lens are you looking through, and how does that change your view of God?
Mm. Yeah. And the thing is that I taught ethics for quite a few years, so I had to work on some of these things from a different perspective. And it seemed to me that the design law that God gave us, which we say is embodied in the Ten Commandments, is the design law of love. Mm-hmm. It's descriptive law. It is not prescriptive law.
Right.
And I've tried to teach that to my students, to help them realize that God is not punitive. He is trying to prevent us from experiencing the outfall, mm-hmm. the downfall,
yeah.
Of what our actions will take us.
Mm. I believe that, well, I call God's quotes laws are principles that have inherent power within them, whereas laws, the way we do laws, have no power. So you have to use external force to intimidate people to try to convince them to keep the law, and even though that doesn't work real well either, but
and when you're dealing
sort of, but the principles actually have power built into them, divine power, I think, and how we relate to in relation, it's a relationship, how we relate to all of those principles releases that power. When we interact with a principle, it releases the power inherent in the principle. If you violate the law, the principle, what is released is a curse. When you are in harmony with the principle, what is released is a blessing. Throughout history, it's attributed to God arbitrarily cursing and blessing. And he'll let you think that. But I think in reality, he built it right into the very design of the universe. And he's trying to instruct us that I want you to live in harmony with the principles because they will release life into you. It's this abundant life. It's the thriving life. It's the joy. It's the fulfillment. You know, it's the passion of what you were created for. That's the blessing when you live in harmony with the principles that are designed to release life. When you violate these principles, whatever they are, then you're twisting them. And what was meant for life comes out as a curse. And it sucks life out of you because you're crosswise, which is transgression of the principle.
Could I suggest something from 1 John? That those principles have no effect on us apart from the relationship.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was
we love because he first loved us. We can't love of ourselves. And God, only God, is the source of love.
And you're just now bringing up the verse that says love is the fulfillment of the law. In other words, God equals the law. God is love. See,
we tend to put this so close to legal model thinking, mm-hmm. that we lose the power of love, because love has no power apart from relationships.
Right.
But the good news is that there are people who have a relationship with God who don't even know who God is.
Well, yes, that's thank true. You for bringing that up, because you know that's where I was going to go.
No, I didn't. But now that I think of it, yeah.
Before you go there, I want to make a comment. Floyd talked about design or the creation. And it just occurred to me, I mean, as God was showing his power in creation, but his crowning act in the sixth day was to reveal to Adam that he was missing something. Right? It became obvious to Adam. It was like God just showing him a hint. Look at the male and female horses. Look at the male and female this. Look at the and he's just hinting. And he could have given Adam power or more power. Would that have been the answer? No. He created Eve. Here's your equal. Here's your helpmate. And there's then
a relationship.
Yeah. And then to top that off, he rests. He spends the whole Friday evening with them and the next morning with them and demonstrates that love. Like Gene was sharing, you know, love isn't something that we initiate. That's love is something we respond to. Yes. And so it's that creation is just that whole message is, yeah, it's power. But that wasn't the final revelation. The final revelation was God's divine commitment to man and the relationship. That's from Sigve, his book, Lost Significance of the Sabbath.
Back to what you were saying, Bill. It seems that the people who don't know God by name still have a relationship with him, because every time he sends them, or at least most every time, he sends them a message of love in any form that it happens, through another person, through life experiences, through nature, through whatever, they respond to it positively. So they do have a relationship with him. They just don't know it.
That's what it says in Romans, that the invisible things of God are clearly revealed in the things he's created. So they're without excuse.
Right.
And this is the illustration of the vine, the branches, and the fruit.
Yes.
And affiliation, declaration, proclamation, et cetera, doesn't produce them. It's the connection, the relationship. And that's where John, every time I read 1 John, all of that in totality, I just see it so clearly. And I don't know, it was the thing that changed my mind about affiliation and all of that. There will be those who, in our understanding of eschatology, reach the second coming and go, oh, well, this is not what I expected. And it's okay. It's looked forward to. It's not fearful. And they recognize the voice of their conscience as an externality.
So I think that our life on this planet, right now especially, every day we are meeting the necessity and consequently a test of whether or not we are going to respond to love or whether we are going to respond to the pressures to hate.
Mm. Mm.
And I think that those two opposites are going to be the, I don't know what word to use, synopsis, the climax, I don't know what word to use, but the maybe the synthesis of, not synthesis.
The opposite.
The crux of the entire cosmic conflict. In our world.
Well, I think you're saying that in the end, the devil will be known by his demonstration of his government, which will be about power over, coercion, force,
hate.
And Joseph, my mind goes to Joseph, what you meant for evil, God has used for good. Love is more powerful than hate.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing in the end.
Right.
There's a level, and I don't mean to put this on anyone else. For me, I see, because it's not it's not indicative of national war and things like that. There's still a spirit of, because I see this amongst different people, groups around the world. I will kill you for my beliefs versus I would die for my beliefs.
Yes.
And that doesn't have anything to do with necessarily war over resources and national identity, but I'm just saying that amongst people, particularly of strong faith, whatever that is, there falls to those I would kill or those that on which I would die.
I would die for. Mm-hmm.
You don't agree with me, I'll have to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Versus I don't agree with me, and if you, I would rather die than kill you.
Yes. I'd rather be vulnerable than offensive.
Yeah. Jim, and you mentioned the crux of love and then hate. Well, in Revelation 12, what does it say the devil came down with? Great wrath. If you become like what you worship, if you worship God, you become loving. If you worship Satan, you become wrathful or hateful. And we're seeing where people are saying, hate speech is when you just disagree with them, like you hate them. Well, it's really, you might even reach out to them with love, but that's seen as hate in the new paradigm.
And it all comes down to who we end up worshiping, because God is the God of love. And yet Satan will portray himself as God. Mm-hmm. And the world will go after that and say, yeah, God is a God who uses power, force, coercion. And it's okay to kill people that aren't following his dictates. That, that's what Satan's going to be selling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know that we have the time to land this hand grenade, but I do want to discuss, because I think it's going to take some time, the hour of his judgment.
And no, and we do not have that much time.
No. But I don't want to lose it. So I don't want us to think we're done with the first angel.
I think we should start with that next time.
Okay.
I just want to mention in the last verse that cluster, a nation, tribe, people, whatever. I went back and looked at my cross references because I traced that as a thread through Revelation. It shows up 7 times.
Of course it does.
Yeah, of course. What would you expect?
I would just like to make one point to you, since I didn't cover it earlier. Well, if we're going to do judgment, then we do. Yeah, well, I'll do it next time.
Do you want to get?
It's after the judgment, so.
Okay. All right.
I will. I just realized that.
There's a whole lot to unpack in the word glory, too. So,
well, yes.
Give him glory. I think of Ellen White's statement. Whenever we make known the Father or the Son, we give glory to God.
Mm. I like that.
It's actually in the Bible commentary, the old SDA Bible commentary, in connection with this verse.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that was an editorial decision to make it that way, but I think she might have been thinking of that verse anyway.
Sounds a lot like worship.
Yeah. Well, isn't
identity.
So reverence God and give him glory.
Well, Jesus really summed that up in John 17 when he says, Father, the time has come, glorify your Son so that the Son may glorify you. Right before the cross, and he showed us unmistakably who God was.
Well, and
glory.
I was going to say, there's two aspects for me on that, and that is living into what God has called us to as our life has emerged into who we are. So living the purpose with God in relationship is to me, giving God glory. There was another part, and it has escaped me, so maybe I'll remember it next
week. Just one last question, and this is for next week. Has the way we've presented the judgment been one that gave God glory?
Well, yeah, get us started on that one.
Yes, I think that's a good question for next week to go with our discussion.
Well, shall we call it quits? Okay. Father, we want to give you glory. We know our weakness. We know we cannot love apart from being loved by you. We ask that in every way that we interact with others, in every relationship we have, where we can talk to people face to face, we pray that we will give you glory in the way that we treat them with love. We thank you for this in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.